I'll be reading from Exodus 15, 1 through 3. Then Moses and the children of Israel sang this song to the Lord and spoke, saying, I will sing to the Lord, for he has triumphed gloriously. The horse and its rider he has thrown into the sea. The Lord is my strength and song, and he has become my salvation. He is my God, and I will praise him, my Father's God, and I will exalt him. The Lord is a man of war. The Lord is his name.
Good evening. We're doing our Preaching Through the Bible series, looking at the 17 time periods. We're trying to get through the entire Bible in a year. So far, we have hit four of the time periods, and this is part two of the Egyptian captivity and Exodus. This period extends from Exodus chapter 1 to Numbers 14. And what we did was we got through the Red Sea last week, and we are actually going to get through the rest of this. And this feels like a really big chunk of the Bible, and it is, but if you remember that a great portion of this is going over the law. So we're going to skip over the law, and we're going to focus on just a few of the moments that are found in the context here of things that actually are performed by Israel. In fact, the first place we're going to start is Exodus chapter 19. So if you'll turn there, if you'll turn to Exodus chapter 19, so as I said, we got through the Red Sea before, and as we come up here on Exodus 19, what we've already seen is, as Nathan read for us, the song of Moses in chapter 15, which parts of it are quoted here in Psalms, okay? Psalm 106, to be precise. There's also, I believe, Psalm 76 has some bits of that song as well. And after this song of thanking God for destroying Egypt for them so they could continue on their exodus without any issue from Egypt, then in the next few bits, we see that God is providing for his people. He gives them water. He gives them manna. He gives them meat. And we also see miraculous dealings, like not just the manna and the meat, but also water being brought from a rock. And as we get into the beginning of chapter 19, it says the third month, verse 1, after the sons of Israel had gone out of the land of Egypt on that very day, they came into the wilderness of Sinai. And Moses is actually going to climb the mountain in verse 3. It says Moses went up to God, and the Lord called to him from the mountain. But we don't actually see God truly come down until verse 18. There is a little bit in verse 16, thunder, lightning, a thick cloud on the mountain. But in verse 18 is where we see the Lord descends upon the mountain. So that's where we're going to start. We're going to look at verses 18 through 25. Now, Mount Sinai was all in smoke because the Lord descended upon it in fire. And its smoke ascended like the smoke of a furnace. And the whole mountain quaked violently. When the sound of the trumpet grew louder and louder, Moses spoke and God answered him with thunder. The Lord came down on Mount Sinai to the top of the mountain, and the Lord called Moses to the top of the mountain, and Moses went up. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, "Go down, warn the people, so that they do not break through to the Lord to gaze, and many of them perish. Also let the priests who come near to the Lord consecrate themselves, or else the Lord will break out against them." Moses said to the Lord, "The people cannot come up to Mount Sinai, for you warned us, saying, 'Set bounds about the mountain and consecrate it.'" Then the Lord said to him, "Go down and come up again, you and Aaron with you, but do not let the priests and the people break through to come up to the Lord, or he will break forth upon them." So Moses went down to the people and told them. I love Moses' reaction here in verse 23. The people can't come up because we told them not to. Oh, Moses, that's so cute that we think the Israelites are going to do what you tell them to. In this case, they do, though, so that's nice. This will be one of very few moments throughout their wandering in the wilderness, their making their way through their exodus when they actually listen to God. And sadly, as we get further into the lesson, that's going to become more and more true. But here we see that there is this amazing spectacle that happens where God comes down, there's fire, there's smoke, there's thunder, there's lightning, the mountain is shaking. It's an incredible sight. And to no one's surprise, the Israelites are absolutely terrified. They should be. This is God. They should be absolutely terrified. And it says in verse 21, the people stood at a distance while Moses approached the thick cloud where God was. They said, "You speak to God for us because we're too afraid." Well, as this all starts, the first thing that God gives Moses is the Ten Commandments. And that is from verses 1 down through verse 17. Okay, so God descends upon Mount Sinai, and then we have the Ten Commandments here. Before he gives the Ten Commandments, he reminds them, "I am the Lord your God, who brought you out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of slavery." That is really important. The very first thing God says to them as he descends onto Mount Sinai is, "I am God, I brought you out of Egypt." Very important in our next section, in our next slide, okay? But the first one, "You shall have no other gods before me." God is the one that saves them, and so purely from a thankfulness standpoint, there's no other god that helped them. The Egyptian gods certainly didn't help them, and Egypt was the powerhouse of the day, so by typical human belief, none of the other gods would have been able to overpower Egypt, right? Because that's how mythology worked at the time. Of course, this is all assuming that any of these gods were actually real, which they're not. But he says, "You shall have no other gods before me. There is nothing that takes the place of the one that saved them." Then, "You shall not make for yourself an idol or any likeness of what is in heaven above, or on the earth beneath, or in the water under the earth." So there's a few different translations here. Sometimes it's graven images, sometimes it's idols. But notice here, what are you supposed to carve the image of? Well, it's something that you've already seen. You have to model it after creation, because how do you model that which exists outside of your understanding, that exists outside of your universe? Well, that's not really possible. So what he's saying is, if it looks like anything that I've created, then you've missed the point. Again, very important for in our next section. "You shall not worship them or serve them, for I, the Lord your God, am a jealous God, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children, on the third and fourth generations of those who hate me, but showing loving kindness to thousands, to those who love me and keep my commandments." Okay? So already, no other gods, no idols, and don't worship them. Then, the next one, "You shall not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, For the Lord will not leave him unpunished who takes his name in vain. So a lot of times where what we have done with this passage is we have said that this has to do with not using foul language. The Bible says we're not supposed to use foul language. That hasn't changed. This is not the verse for that. What the Hebrew phrase here, taking the Lord's name in vain, what it's actually a reference to is not going out and using God's name to justify your sin. That's actually what the idea here is about taking the Lord's name in vain. You still should not use God's name as a curse or any such thing. That's not showing reverence to God. So that's still true. We're not saying that that's not true. It's just not what the Hebrew phrase here is referencing. So, for instance, what you're going to see throughout the Old Testament are people saying, well, God has sent me to do such and such. Well, no, he hasn't. God told me to do this. No, he didn't. Those are using God's name in vain without his authority. Okay. And then remember the Sabbath to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor and do all your work. But the seventh day is a Sabbath day of the Lord your God. In it you shall not do any work, you or your son or your daughter, your male or your female servant, or your cattle or your sojourner who stays with you. For in 6 days the Lord made the heaven and earth, the sea and all that is in them, and rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. So if you remember when Jesus is asked, what is the greatest commandment in the law? He says the first is love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength. And then he says the second is love your neighbor as yourself. Well, already here, the first four are about loving God and putting him first. What do you think the other six are going to be about? Well, let's see. The first, honor your father and mother, that your days may be prolonged in the land which the Lord your God gives you. One of the first conditional promises of obedience listed in the Bible, honor your father and mother, that your days may be prolonged. Then you shall not murder. Some Bibles say kill, and most Hebrew scholars will say that's a poor translation of the word because the word really is murder. If God said you shall not kill, he gives them a lot of means of executing people and killing people. And then he'll even tell them to go into the land of Canaan and kill all the Canaanites. So that's going to be quite contradictory. The better word here is murder. Okay, the unlawful killing of another human being. You shall not commit adultery. You shall not steal. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. You shall not covet your neighbor's house, covet your neighbor's wife, his male servant, his female servant, his ox, his donkey, or anything that belongs to your neighbor. So shockingly, the last six are about loving others, loving your neighbor as yourself. And Jesus said, on these two hang all the law and the prophets. Well, yes, it does. Because what we find is all the rest of the law given, this is a summary. And there are those who will say the Ten Commandments is different from the law. I have a sermon about that if you want to go and look on either our YouTube channel or our website, roanridge.org. I have a sermon about how the Ten Commandments is in fact the law of God. So you can go and see that if that's something that you currently believe right now, and perhaps I can change your mind. But these Ten Commandments are a summary of all the law and all the ins and outs, all the little loopholes and things that God has given to the people. And so that's why I wanted to cover the Ten Commandments, because what we see from here on is God giving the law to Moses hereafter. That's going to be chapters 20 through 23, our commandments. Then there's a reaffirmation of the covenant in chapter 24. And then in chapters 25 through 31, he gives how to make the tabernacle, what the priest should wear and what the priest should do, some different worship practices that the priests were supposed to engage in, etc., etc. Then we get to chapter 32. If you remember those four, No other gods before me. Don't make yourself an idol of any likeness of creation. Do not take the name of the Lord your God in vain, and remember the Sabbath. Just keep those in mind as we get into chapter 32. So at the beginning of chapter 32, Moses has been up on the mountain for quite a bit of time. It says the people saw that Moses delayed to come down from the mountain. Okay, so they seem to be concerned for Moses. Oh, he's been up there for a while. Which, by the way, as we started tonight in Exodus chapter 19, we saw that God came down on the mountain. And this is an argument from silence, so we always have to be careful with those. But there is not one passage that mentions that God's presence has departed from the mountain. So they're here on the ground looking up at the mountain, and apparently God is still there. And yet they no longer perceive him with fear. They're simply concerned about Moses. Okay? So they assembled about Aaron and said to him, "Come, make us a God who will go before us. As for this Moses, the man who brought us up from the land of Egypt, we do not know what has become of him." So two big problems here. First, if you have to say make a God, you're probably on the wrong foot. Because a God who is a God is not made. He is. He is eternity, and therefore cannot be made by us. And this is a violation of the first three commandments. So already we've got a problem. But then, once again, remember what God said before he gave the Ten Commandments. "I am the Lord your God," make us a God. "And I am the one who brought you up out of Egypt." But notice what they said here. "This Moses, the man who brought us up from the land of Egypt." No, God brought you up from the land of Egypt. Not Moses. He was the one that God appointed to lead you, but God is the one who brought you up from Egypt. So Aaron says, okay, he capitulates here. I've never understood why. It doesn't say whether he's feeling the pressure of the people or not. He seems to be really for this idea, especially when he tries to give his defense before Moses later. But Aaron, remember what we said earlier, don't make an image that's based on anything in creation. Well, he takes the gold, and remember they were given a lot of gold and clothes as they left Egypt. So all these gold rings that they had, they give it to Aaron, and it says he took this from their hand and fashioned it with a graving tool and made it into a molten calf. That does not take just a matter of hours. This takes a long time. So all this time, he didn't once apparently think, maybe I should stop. And then he makes an even worse decision. After he's made this, he says, "This is your God, O Israel, who brought you up from the land of Egypt." And if that wasn't bad enough, when Aaron saw this, he built an altar before it, and Aaron made a proclamation and said, "Tomorrow shall be a feast to Yahweh." That's what that the Lord is there. That's the name of God. So it's bad enough that he made this idol that God said not to do. He names it after God. He says, "We'll make a feast to the Lord, to Yahweh. This is the God that brought you up from the land of Egypt." No, he's sitting at the top of the mountain. And you did this all in front of him. And God warns Moses. They go down. And he's angry. God is understandably extremely angry. And Moses is able to entreat the Lord to, as it says in verse 14, change his mind about the harm which he said he would do to his people. But then we see that later, Moses, in verse 20, he takes the calf, grinds it to powder, and puts it in the water and makes Israel drink the water. And then we see that there are those of the tribe of Levi, verse 26, whoever is for the Lord, come to me, and all the sons of Levi gathered together to him. Not anyone else, apparently, sadly. And so Levi, the sons of Levi do as Moses instructed. It says they strap a sword to his thigh and they go back and forth from gate to gate in the camp. Kill every man his brother, every man his friend, and every man his neighbor. There has to be more to it than that, because that just sounds like kill everyone, which is exactly what he asked God not to do. And there's only 3,000 people. I say only. That's a lot of people that's died, and I'm not meaning to undercut that. But when they left Egypt, there was 600,000 men, and it says men who were walking. So that's the idea of being able-bodied. So there would have been more men than that that were not able-bodied. And then on top of that, women, children, it would have easily been a host of 2 million people. And so 3,000 is not much in the grand scheme, but still sad that anyone had to die, especially 3,000 people. So already, we're having some trouble. We have gone 3 months from Egypt, and we have begun to worship other gods. Calling it the God that brought us up out of Egypt, but you made it. It's just a calf. It doesn't really mean anything. Okay. Right here, it's going to tell us that they are going to depart. But the actual leaving of Sinai doesn't appear to happen until Numbers chapter 10. But God is going to, in chapter 34, he's going to take the tablets. Remember, Moses broke the tablets when he saw them worshiping the golden calf. The tablets that had the Ten Commandments, he broke them. And God makes new ones, and he also renews the covenant with them. And in chapter 34, verse 29 is our next place that we're going to read. Chapter 34 and verse 29. It came about when Moses was coming down from Mount Sinai, and the two tablets of the testimony were in Moses' hand as he was coming down from the mountain, that Moses did not know that the skin of his face shone because of his speaking with him. That him is God. So when Aaron and all the sons of Israel saw Moses, behold, the skin of his face shone, and they were afraid to come near him. Then Moses called to them, and Aaron and all the rulers in the congregation returned to him, and Moses spoke to them. Afterward, all the sons of Israel came near, and he commanded them to do everything that the Lord had spoken to him on Mount Sinai. When Moses had finished speaking with them, he put a veil over his face. But whenever Moses went in before the Lord to speak with him, he would take the veil off until he came out. And whenever he came out and spoke to the sons of Israel what he had been commanded, the sons of Israel would see the face of Moses, that the skin of Moses' face shone. So Moses would replace the veil over his face until he went in to speak with him. And notice here, he doesn't immediately put the veil back on when he speaks the word of God. It seems that he speaks the word of God and then puts the veil over his face. So he takes it off to converse with God and then say whatever God's words were, and then he would put it back on. So this comes from Moses speaking with God. He is engaging in communication with God. And notice here that because his face is shining, they're afraid. And so he uses this veil to try to allay some of their fears. And we're going to come back to this point when we get to the end of our lesson. But just think about the ramifications of this as we move into the New Testament at the end of the lesson and what this would mean for us as Christians. Just keep that in mind. We will come back to it. Then the tabernacle is built, and then there's this moment where the glory of the Lord in chapter 40 comes and rests over the tabernacle. And his presence is so strong, not even Moses can go in to the tabernacle until the appointed time. And then we hit Leviticus. And Leviticus, as we have been studying it on Wednesday nights, hopefully you are getting out of it as much as I and Tim have been getting out of it. But there are two moments in the book of Leviticus that actually tell some narrative rather than just giving the law. The first happens in chapters 9 and 10. There are sacrifices being given by Aaron and his sons. And then in chapter 10, Nadab and Abihu offer strange fire, is the way that it puts it, and God burns them up. So the first little episode here outside of the law of God is God is to be revered. And then the other lesson in Leviticus is chapter 24, where they stone a blasphemer. And it would be the same lesson, but in the negative. Do not blaspheme God. So hold God with reverence and do not blaspheme him. Which seems like a pretty good summary of Leviticus. But there is a whole lot more to Leviticus than just that. And then we get into Numbers chapter 1. That there is a census of warriors. And the Levites are of course left out of that. Because they are serving the Lord. And then how the camps are supposed to be arranged, chapter 2. Chapter 3 is where we see God has already mentioned back in Exodus that he wanted all the firstborn sons to be his priests. But after the moment with the golden calf, God has changed the way he's planning on doing things, which is where he has the Levites serve him rather than just the firstborn, and the Israelite people have to redeem the firstborn from God by giving money to the Levites so that they can perform their duties for the Lord. And then there are certain groups of these Levites, the Kohathites, the Gershonites, and the Merarites, and their duties are outlined in chapter 4. And then starting in chapter 5, there's rules and regulations through chapter 9, verse 14. Chapter 9, verse 15, we see God's cloud here is mentioned, the one that does hover over the tabernacle and leads the people. And then, as I said earlier, chapter 10 is where we actually see the official leaving of Sinai. And then there is in the end of chapter 11, well, almost at the end of 11, Moses actually complains to the Lord after the people complain in the first 9 verses. Moses complains to the Lord and basically says, if you expect me to keep dealing with these people like this, you might as well kill me. And that's actually almost verbatim what he says. He does say, please take my life. And God says, all right, let's establish what Jethro actually told him to do, which was establish what then becomes the 70 elders. And some of this seems to be things that were already in place all the way back in Exodus when they're going up to Mount Sinai. So it seems that we're sort of going back to those things and rehashing them, which is probably why we have Exodus 33 and now Exodus chapter 10, both leaving Mount Sinai. It's probably that we're going over some details that were missed in Exodus. And then the quail is given once again. So we saw manna and quail before, and now there's an explanation of that given here. And then Miriam and Aaron are going to start murmuring along with the people in chapter 12, and they are punished for that. Particularly Miriam is punished for that she is stricken with leprosy and then healed. And now we're going to get to Numbers chapter 13. Numbers chapter 13. This is the last of our Old Testament passages that we're going to look at. Numbers chapter 13. In Numbers chapter 13, the spies are chosen to go into Canaan. If you remember correctly, when they first left, God said, I could take them by the way of the Philistines into Canaan, which would be following the Mediterranean Sea, but he's concerned that they're going to immediately turn tail and run. And so they've had this moment where they're dealing with Egypt, the Red Sea, all of this going through the wilderness, and God providing for them. So now God says, okay, now let's give them a taste of what the land is like. And so they send out 12 men, one from each tribe. Shammua from Reuben, Shaphat from Simeon, Caleb of Judah, Egal of Issachar, Hoshea of Ephraim, that's Joshua, the tribe Palti of Benjamin, Gadiel from Zebulun, Gadi from Manasseh, Amiel from Dan, Sether from Asher, Nabi from Naphtali, and Geuel from Gad. These are the names of the men Moses sent to spy out the land. But Moses called Hoshea the son of Nun Joshua. So if you said, how did I just pick out Hoshea, that's Joshua? Well, there you go. If you didn't know that earlier, here he explains it in verse 16. We've already seen him called Joshua, but God gives his official name of Hoshea. But Moses calls him Joshua. And by the way, Joshua is the same name in Hebrew as Jesus. Okay. And so they go out to spy the land. They went out for 40 days, is what we read in verse 25. They returned at the end of 40 days. They saw some incredible things. For instance, a single cluster of grapes in verse 23 that had to be carried on a pole between two people. That's how big the cluster of grapes was. And there it says also they had pomegranates and figs. Can you believe how much the Canaanites had that they were squandering their thankfulness to God? And so now they're seeing it and thinking, this is incredible. It is an amazing land, and they admit that in verse 27. We went into the land where you sent us, and it certainly does flow with milk and honey, and this is its fruit. They brought the fruit back. But there are people who live there, and they're really scary. And it particularly points out the descendants of Anak, which are giants. And Goliath seems to come from that descendancy, he and his brothers. And then they point out all the different kinds of Canaanites that are there in verse 29. But notice that Caleb in verse 30 speaks up and says, hold on, we should by all means go up and take possession of it, for we will surely overcome it. But the men who had gone up with him said, we are not able to go up against the people, for they are too strong for us. So they gave out to the sons of Israel a bad report on the land, which they had spied out, saying, the land through which we have gone in spying it out is a land that devours its inhabitants, and all the people whom we saw in it are men of great size. What I love here is, you know who takes care of the majority, because we know there are some giants that are left by the time David comes along. But do you know who is responsible for the slaying of the giants? Caleb. And it says he's 85. And he's going out slaying giants. You want to know why? We should by all means go up and take possession of it. Caleb's like, well, what are we standing here talking about? God is with us. He saved us from Egypt, in case you forgot all the 10 plagues. He saved us from Egypt. He saved us from Egypt with the Red Sea. He's provided for us. He's given us water where there was none. Instead of having poisoned water, the waters of Marah, which was all the way back in Exodus chapter 15, God has done all this for us, and what, he's going to be stopped by a few giants? Yeah, okay. This is Caleb's thought. And we're going to see later that Joshua absolutely agrees. That's going to be chapter 14, verse 6. They tear their clothes and speak to all the congregation of Israel and say, this is a bad idea for us to not go through with this. But we see in verse 2 of chapter 14, would that we had died in the land of Egypt, or would that we had died in this wilderness. Why is the Lord bringing us into this land to fall by the sword? You remember, this is exactly how the Exodus started. What, there weren't graves in Egypt? Now we're pushed up to the Red Sea and Egypt's just going to come and wipe us out? God saved them then. Are we not going to think the same thing? No, our wives and our little ones will become plunder. Would it not be better for us to return to Egypt? So they said to one another, let us appoint a leader and return to Egypt. They've been given amazing blessings for the last 3+ months. It's been a lot longer than 3 months by this point. But now they want to go back to abject slavery. That's what they want to do. And they decide that's exactly what they're going to do. But notice here it says, Moses and Aaron fell on their faces in the presence of all the assembly of the congregation of Israel. And what that is it's a sign of reverence to the Lord. They are responding to what the Lord is inevitably going to respond to the Israelites' choice here. And then we see Joshua and Caleb tear their clothes, and they sort of repeat what Caleb said here. But in verse 9, do not rebel against the Lord. Do not fear the people of the land, for they will be our prey. Their protection has been removed from them. The Lord is with us. Do not fear them. Verse 10, but all the congregation said to, stone them with stones. So all they're doing is saying, let's not rebel against God, and let's go in and take the land. They're not saying, you're a horrible group of people. They do say, don't rebel. So I guess you could say, well, you're calling us a rebellious people, but that's exactly what you're doing. But the congregation feels that their words are worth stoning. Which, by the way, anybody want to venture which law that follows? Because I'll tell you, it's not in there. There are 605 laws in the old law, approximately. Not one of them says, stone someone for trying to be encouraging. And so the Lord, once again, how long will this people spurn me? How long will they not believe in me? Despite all the signs which I have performed in their midst, I will smite them with pestilence and dispossess them, and I will make you into a nation greater and mightier than they. But Moses, true to form, backs them up. He's an advocate for them. We mentioned before in last week showing how Moses is like Jesus. Here you go. What did we just talk about this morning? 1 John chapter 2, verse 1. If anyone sins, he has an advocate with the Father, Jesus Christ the righteous. Well, here's Moses. The Israelites are making a grave mistake. But Moses is saying, hold on, Lord, you need to do this because you are righteous. Think about what other people are going to say about the God that brought his people out of Egypt and then just killed them all off in the wilderness. And he even praises the Lord in verse 18. The Lord is slow to anger and abundant in loving kindness, forgiving iniquity and transgression. He will by no means clear the guilty, visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generations. So in verse 20, The Lord pardons them. He says, okay, I will pardon them because you asked. But he declares that there will be a purging. 20 years old and upward, all who have grumbled against me. And the only exceptions here are Caleb and Joshua, because they delivered a good report. So they get to go into the land above the age of 60, right? Because 20 years old and up, and there's going to be 40 years of wandering in the wilderness. So they'll be the only ones over the age of 60. At least, I do believe that this is, it says even all your numbered men, 20 years old and up, but he also has this tag, who have grumbled against me. There are those who have said, well, it's not all, it's just those who have grumbled, but that doesn't seem to be what happens later. And then God says, you're going to be wandering for 40 years, 1 year for every day they spied out the land. So they're going to wander in the wilderness for 40 years. And here's the thing, God said, okay, here's how this is going to work. And then Israel decides to have some remorse. Which on the one hand, you want to say, good for you for feeling remorse. But look at what happens, verse 39. Moses spoke these words to all the sons of Israel, and the people mourned greatly. In the morning, however, they rose up early, went up to the ridge of the hill country, saying, here we are, we have indeed sinned. Oh, that's okay, good. Good start. But we will go up to the place which the Lord has promised. No, he just said not to. What is the matter with you? Even when you're trying to be righteous, you're unrighteous. That's a special level of stupid. And Moses is quick to point this out. Why then are you transgressing the commandment of the Lord when it will not succeed? Do not go up, or you'll be struck down before your enemies, for the Lord is not among you. The Amalekites and the Canaanites will be there in front of you. You will fall by the sword, inasmuch as you have turned back from following the Lord, and the Lord will not be with you. Do you not realize the mistake you are about to make? No, they don't. They went up heedlessly to the ridge of the hill country. Neither the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord nor Moses left the camp. The Amalekites and the Canaanites who lived in that hill country came down and struck them and beat them down as far as Hormah. So Israel disobeys even when they're trying to obey. I always have to remember, when I talk about Israel, I'm talking about myself. We see it in the Israelites and we say, how stupid. And then, oh, here I am sinning against the Lord again. It's just as bad. It's just as stupid. Sometimes we rush headlong when God says, okay, here's what you're not supposed to do. We say, not supposed to do, got it. Not supposed to do, supposed to do. Sounds like the same thing, and then we rush off and do it. And then there's God sitting up there on his throne going, what did I just say? I know I can speak all the languages of the universe, but I know I spoke it in your language. I know you could understand me. But we do it anyway. One thing that we didn't read as much here, we did read bits of it, but if you wanted to have a summary of the journey so far, it would be grumbling and complaining. And God warns us in Philippians chapter 2 and verse 14, do all things without grumbling or complaining. Don't follow in Israel's footsteps. And Paul says this on multiple occasions, not just in Philippians, but specifically points out, don't make the mistakes that Israel makes. He makes that point in Romans. He makes that point in Galatians. And here in Philippians, he's referring to this as well, I think. Do all things without grumbling or complaining. This is one that we don't do very well. Especially because we're Americans and we have things the way we like them. And when things aren't working quite right, we get very upset. And we don't stop and think about the blessings that we have. I'm going to have to wait 5 minutes for my Uber instead of two. The air conditioning is out in my car. Well, at least your car is running. At least you have a car. You have a way of getting 20 miles in 20 minutes. When that would have taken the Israelites an entire day to travel that far. Roll down your windows. Quit complaining. Because God has blessed us incredibly. And as we were talking about in James this morning, we become a very spoiled people. When you look at the poverty line here in America, those who are at the poverty line are among the richest 10% of the entire world. And we consider them the less fortunate. We are a very affluent people. Be careful what's worth complaining about. Because God says don't do it. Pure and simple. He did tell them not to do it. Maybe not in so many words. But he says, here, look at everything I've done for you, Israel. You just left us out here to die. Okay, which part of giving you water, giving you manna, giving you meat, saving you from Egypt, which part of that is I wanted to just bring you out in the wilderness and kill you? We have to make sure we don't follow in their footsteps. And along with this, why there is no grumbling and complaining? Because God is always providing for our needs. That's the entire point of Matthew chapter 6. Verses 25 through 34, why are you worrying about the things that God is going to do for you? God takes care of the rest of His creation, and we are special because we are made in the image of Him. We are more important to Him than the birds of the air or the flowers of the field. But God gives them what they need. Surely He's going to give you what you need. Now, lest we mistake, this is not the prosperity gospel. God is not going to fill your bank account magically. But He will make sure you're provided for if you maintain faith. And sometimes that provision comes from His children. The Israelites missed God's glory even when it was right in front of them. This one is a big one for me when I was writing this lesson. We have to be careful that we see God's glory everywhere, because it is everywhere. And it's not just some mantra to repeat when I'm trying to meditate. No, that's not what this is. God's glory is everywhere because He is everywhere. Because He is wonderful. He is marvelous. And then people make choices that do not reflect that idea. People make choices not to be with their fellow Christians. People make choices to not worship God every day of their life. People make conscious choices to not study their Bibles, to not pray, to not think about Him and His Son and the gratitude that we ought to have. God's glory is everywhere. And too often, it is as though we are standing at the bottom of Mount Sinai and there is His presence at the top of the mountain. The two college majors that produce the most Christians out of atheists. There was a study done about this a few years ago. This is a 2015 study, I believe. That those who started atheist and turned out Christian at the end of the program were astronomy and microbiology. Because whether you look deep within our own selves or you look out into the vast stretches of the universe, it is impossible not to see God in all of his glory. And at night, I can just go look and see God's glory. We have no excuse. Our last point here goes to Moses and his face shining. I told you we'd come back to this. Our faces shine when we commune with our God as well. It may not be a physical shining. It may not be some supernatural effect. But I want you to turn with me to 2 Corinthians chapter 3. 2 Corinthians chapter 3. We're going to start in verse 12. Therefore, having such a hope, which is a hope based in the glory of God, contextually, we use great boldness in our speech and are not like Moses, who used to put a veil over his face so that the sons of Israel would not look intently at the end of what was fading away. But their minds were hardened, for until this very day, at the reading of the old covenant, the same veil remains unlifted, because it's removed in Christ. But to this day, whenever Moses is read, a veil lies over their heart. But whenever a person turns to the Lord, the veil is taken away, just like he would go speak with the Lord and he would remove the veil. The Lord is the Spirit, and where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is liberty. But we all, with unveiled face, beholding as in a mirror the glory of the Lord, are being transformed into the same image from glory to glory, just as from the Lord the Spirit. When we commune with Christ and with God in his word, we reveal God's will. That's what Moses was doing, revealing God's will. And do you remember what happened when they saw the shining face? What happened? They were all terrified. And you know what happens? People see us living the truth of Christ and they want nothing to do with us. It's a terrifying thing to them to see people actually living up to the expectations of God, at least to the best of our ability, as much as our humanity will allow, and we do what we can for our Lord. But this is how people respond when we live out God's truth. Tonight, we have to make a conscious choice to not be like Israel. As we move into next Sunday night, we're going to get into the wandering of the wilderness and what happens with the people during that time. But look at how they've already set themselves up for this wandering in the wilderness. And the thing is, this is what happens. This is what happens to people who live out there in the world. They have access to the exodus from their sin. But they either don't want to listen, or they get into it a little bit and they start grumbling and complaining about what God has asked of them, when it is a far cry from who they are without him. Let us not make that mistake. Living our lives without God is the worst thing, not just for how our lives will unfold here on this earth, but for eternity. And there are people that willingly and consciously choose to go back to their Egypt. Jesus warned about this in the parable of the sower. When the soil is not what it ought to be to receive the word implanted, whatever comes up will die. Whatever comes up is choked out, is beaten down by the sun, or snatched away by the devil himself laying on the side of the road. And sometimes that's where we find ourselves. We find that we have not properly tilled our field. That there are times where we have to reap and replant. But we haven't prepared ourselves properly. And if that's what you need tonight, well, you're going to have an opportunity. We're going to sing, "Bring Christ Your Broken Life." And while we're singing this song, you have an opportunity to do what Israel never did as a whole, which is come to the Lord fully. And you don't have to repeat their mistake. Please come forward as we stand and as we sing.
Bring Christ your broken life.